Chapter 8. Then how did you find me? The young farmer smiled a springtime smile. I dropped into that home restaurant next door this evening, said he. Don't care who knows it. I like a dish of some kind of greens at this time of the year. I ran my eye down that nice typewritten bill of fare looking for something in that line. When I got below cabbage, I turned my chair over and hollered for the proprietor. He told me where you lived. I remember, sighed Sarah, happily. Hat was dandelions below cabbage. I know that cranky capital W way above the line that your typewriter makes anywhere in the world, said Franklin. Why, there's no W in dandelions, said Sarah, in surprise. The young man drew the bill of fare from his pocket and pointed to a line. Sarah recognized the first card as he had typewritten that afternoon. There was still the rate splotch in the upper right-hand corner where a tear had fallen. But over the spot where one should have read the name of the meadow plant, the clinging memory of their golden blossoms had allowed her fingers to strike strange keys. Between the red cabbage and the stuffed green peppers was the item. Dearest Walter, with hard-boiled egg. The green door, suppose you should be walking down Broadway after dinner, with 10 minutes allotted to the consummation of your cigar, while you are choosing between a diverting tragedy and something serious in the way of vaudeville. Suddenly a hand is laid upon your arm. You turn to look into the thrilling eyes of a beautiful woman, wonderful in diamonds and Russian sables. She thrusts hurriedly into your hand an extremely hot buttered roll, flashes out a tiny pair of scissors, snips off the second button of your overcoat, meaningly ejaculates the one word, parallelogram, and swiftly flies down a cross street, looking back fearfully over her shoulder. That would be pure adventure. Would you accept it? Not you. You would flush with embarrassment. You would sheepishly drop the roll, and continue down Broadway, fumbling feebly for the missing button. This you would do, unless you are one of the blessed few in whom the pure spirit of adventure is not dead. True adventurers have never been plentiful. They who are set down in print as such have been mostly businessmen with newly invented methods. They have been out after the things they wanted: golden fleeces, holy grails, lady loves, treasure, crowns and fame. The true adventurer goes forth aimless and uncalculating to meet and greet unknown fate. A fine example was the prodigal son, when he started back home. Half adventurers, brave and splendid figures, have been numerous. Greater than from the Crusades to the Palisades, they have enriched the arts of history and fiction, and the trade of historical fiction. But each of them had a prize to win, a goal to kick, an axe to grind, a race to run, a new thrust in tears to deliver, a name to carve, a crow to pick, so they were not followers of true adventure. In the big city, the twin spirits romance and adventure are always abroad seeking worthy wooers. As we roam the streets, they slyly peep at us, and challenge us in 20 different guises. Without knowing why, we look up suddenly, to see in a window a face that seems to belong to our gallery of intimate portraits. In a sleeping thoroughfare, we hear a cry of agony and fear coming from an empty and shuttered house. Instead of at our familiar curb, a cab driver deposits us before a strange door, which one, with a smile, opens for us and bids us enter. A slip of paper, written upon, flutters down to our feet from the high lattices of chance. We exchange glances of instantaneous hate, affection and fear with hurrying strangers in the passing crowds. A sudden douse of rain and our umbrella may be sheltering the daughter of the full moon, and first cousin of the sidereal system. At every corner handkerchiefs drop, fingers beckon, eyes beseech, and the lost, the lonely, the rapturous, the mysterious, the perilous, changing clues of adventure are slipped into our fingers. But few of us are willing to hold and follow them. We are grown stiff with the ramrod of convention down our backs. We pass on, and someday we come, at the end of a very dull life, to reflect that our romance has been a pallid thing of a marriage or two, a satin rosette kept in a safe deposit drawer, and a lifelong feud with a steam radiator. Rudolf Steiner was a true adventurer. Few were the evenings on which he did not go forth from his hall bedchamber in search of the unexpected and the egregious. The most interesting thing in life seemed to him to be what might lie just around the next corner. Sometimes his willingness to tempt fate led him into strange paths. Twice he had spent the night in a station house. Again and again he had found himself the dupe of ingenious and mercenary tricksters. His watch and money had been the price of one flattering allurement. But with undiminished ardor he picked up every glove cast before him into the merry lists of adventure. One evening Rudolf was strolling along a crosstown street in the older central part of the city. Two streams of people filled the sidewalks, the home hurrying, and that restless contingent that abandons home for the specious welcome of the 1000-candle-power-tilde-table-d'hote-tilde. The young adventurer was of pleasing presence, and moved serenely and watchfully. By daylight he was a salesman in a piano store. He wore his tie drawn through a topaz ring instead of fastened with a stick pin. And once he had written to the editor of a magazine that Junie's Love Test by Miss Libby had been the book that had most influenced his life. During his walk, a violent chattering of teeth in a glass case on the sidewalk seemed at first to draw his attention with a qualm to a restaurant before which it was set, but a second glance revealed the electric letters of a dentist's sign high above the next door. A giant negro, fantastically dressed in a red embroidered coat, yellow trousers and a military cap, discreetly distributed cards to those of the passing crowd who consented to take them. This mode of dentistic advertising was a common sight to Rudolf. Usually he passed the dispenser of the dentist's cards without reducing his store, but tonight the African slipped one into his hand so deftly that he retained it there, smiling a little at the successful feat. When he had traveled a few yards further, he glanced at the card indifferently. Surprised, he turned it over and looked again with interest. One side of the card was blank, on the other was written in ink three words, "The Green Door." And then Rudolf saw, three steps in front of him, a man throw down the card the negro had given him as he passed. Rudolf picked it up. It was printed with the dentist's name and address and the usual schedule of late work and bridge work and specious promises of endless operations. The adventurous piano salesman halted at the corner and considered. Then he crossed the street, walked down a block, recrossed and joined the upward current of people again. Without seeming to notice the negro as he passed the second time, he carelessly took the card that was handed him. 10 steps away he inspected it. In the same handwriting that appeared on the first card, "The Green Door" was inscribed upon it. 3 or 4 cards were tossed to the pavement by pedestrians both following and leading him. These fell blank side up. Rudolf turned them over. Everyone bore the printed legend of the dental parlors. Rarely did the arch sprite adventure need to beckon twice to Rudolf Steiner, his true follower. But twice it had been done, and the quest was on. Rudolf walked slowly back to where the giant negro stood by the case of rattling teeth. This time as he passed he received no card. In spite of his gaudy and ridiculous garb, the Ethiopian displayed a natural barbaric dignity as he stood, offering the card suavely to some, allowing others to pass unmolested. Every half minute he chanted a harsh, unintelligible phrase akin to the jabber of car conductors and grand opera. And not only did he withhold a card this time, but it seemed to Rudolf that he received from the shining and massive black countenance a look of cold, almost contemptuous disdain. The look stung the adventurer. He read in it a silent accusation that he had been found wanting. Whatever the mysterious written words on the cards might mean, the black had selected him twice from the throng for their recipient, and now seemed to have condemned him as deficient in the wit and spirit to engage the enigma. Standing aside from the rush, the young man made a rapid estimate of the building in which he conceived that his adventure must lie. 5 stories high it rose. A small restaurant occupied the basement. The first floor, now closed, seemed to house millinery or furs. The second floor, by the winking electric letters, was the dentist's. Above this, a polyglot babel of signs struggled to indicate the abodes of palmists, dressmakers, musicians, and doctors. Still higher up, draped curtains and milk bottles white on the windowsills proclaimed the regions of domesticity. After concluding his survey, Rudolph walked briskly up the high flight of stone steps into the house. Up 2 flights of the carpeted stairway he continued, and at its top paused. The hallway there was dimly lighted by 2 pale jets of gas, one far to his right, the other nearer, to his left. He looked toward the nearer light and saw, within its wan halo, a green door. For one moment he hesitated. Then he seemed to see the contumelious sneer of the African juggler of cards, and then he walked straight to the green door and knocked against it. Moments like those that passed before his knock was answered measure the quick breath of true adventure. What might not be behind those green panels? Gamesters at play, cunning rogues baiting their traps with subtle skill, beauty in love with courage, and thus planning to be sought by it. Danger, death, love, disappointment, ridicule, any of these might respond to that temerarious rap. A faint rustle was heard inside, and the door slowly opened. A girl not yet 20 stood there, white-faced and tottering. She loosed the knob and swayed weakly, groping with one hand. Rudolph caught her, and laid her on a faded couch that stood against the wall. He closed the door, and took a swift glance around the room by the light of a flickering gas jet. Neat, but extreme poverty was the story that he read. The girl lay still, as if in a faint. Rudolph looked around the room excitedly for a barrel. People must be rolled upon a barrel who know, that was 4 drowned persons. He began to fan her with his hat. That was successful, for he struck her nose with the brim of his derby, and she opened her eyes. And then the young man saw that hers, indeed, was the one missing face from his art's gallery of intimate portraits. The frank, gray eyes, the little nose, turning pertly outward, the chestnut hair, curling like the tendrils of a pea vine, seemed the right end and reward of all his wonderful adventures. But the face was woefully thin and pale. The girl looked at him calmly, and then smiled. Fainted, didn't I? She asked, weakly. Who wouldn't? You try going without anything to eat for 3 days and see. Himmel! Exclaimed Rudolph, jumping up. Ate till I come back. He dashed out the green door, and down the stairs. In 20 minutes he was back again, kicking at the door with his toe for her to open it. With both arms he hugged an array of wares from the grocery and the restaurant. On the table he laid some bread and butter, cold meats, cakes, pies, pickles, oysters, a roasted chicken, a bottle of milk and 1 of redot tea. This is ridiculous, said Rudolph, blusteringly, to go without eating. You must quit making election bets of this kind. Supper is ready. He helped her to a chair at the table and asked. Is there a cup for the tea? And the shelf by the window, she answered. When he turned again with the cup he saw her, with eyes shining rapturously, beginning upon a huge dill pickle that as he had rooted out from the paper bags with a woman's unerring instinct. He took it from her, laughingly, and poured the cup full of milk. Drink that first, he ordered, and then you shall have some tea, and then a chicken wing. If you are very good you shall have a pickle tomorrow. And now, if you'll allow me to be your guest we'll have supper. He drew up the other chair. The tea brightened the girl's eyes, and brought back some of her color. She began to eat with a sort of dainty ferocity like some starved wild animal. She seemed to regard the young man's presence, and the aid he had rendered her as a natural thing, not as though she undervalued the conventions, but as one whose great stress gave her the right to put aside the artificial for the human. But gradually, with the return of strength and comfort, came also a sense of the little conventions that belong, and she began to tell them her little story. It was one of a thousand such as the city yawns at every day, the shop girl's story of insufficient wages, further reduced by fines that go to swell the store's profits, of time lost through illness, and then of lost positions, lost hope, and the knock of the adventurer upon the green door. But to Rudolph the history sounded as big as the Iliad, or the crisis in Anaya's love test. "To think of you going through all that," he exclaimed. "It was something fierce," said the girl, solemnly. "And you have no relatives or friends in the city?" "None whatever." "I am all alone in the world too," said Rudolph, after a pause. "I am glad of that," said the girl, promptly, and somehow it pleased the young man to hear that she approved of his bereft condition. Very suddenly her eyelids dropped, and she sighed deeply. "I'm awfully sleepy," she said, "and I feel so good." Then Rudolph rose, and took his hat. "I'll say good night. A long night's sleep will be fine for you." He held out his hand, and she took it and said, "Good night." But her eyes asked a question so eloquently, so frankly and pathetically, that he answered it with words. "Oh, I'm coming back tomorrow to see how you are getting along. You can't get rid of me so easily." Then, at the door, as though the way of his coming had been so much less important than the fact that he had come, she asked, "How did you come to knock at my door?" He looked at her for a moment, remembering the cards, and felt a sudden jealous pain. What if they had fallen into other hands as adventurous as his? Quickly he decided that she must never know the truth. He would never let her know that he was aware of the strange expedient to which he had been driven by her great distress. "One of our piano tuners lives in this house," he said. "Knocked at your door by mistake." The last thing he saw in the room before the green door closed was her smile. At the head of the stairway he paused and looked curiously about him. And then he went along the hallway to its other end, and, coming back, ascended to the floor above, and continued his puzzled explorations. Every door that he found in the house was painted green. Wondering, he descended to the sidewalk. The fantastic African was still there. Rudolph confronted him with his two cards in his hand. "Will you tell me why you gave me these cards, and what they mean?" he asked. In a broad, good-natured grin, the Negro exhibited a splendid advertisement of his master's profession. "Dar it is, boss," he said, pointing down the street. "But I spect he was a little late for the first act." Looking the way he pointed, Rudolph saw above the entrance to a theater the blazing electric sign of its new play, The Green Door. "I'm informed that it's a first-rate show, sah," said the Negro. "E agent what represents it presented me with $1, sah, to distribute a few of his cards along with the doctor's. May I offer you one of the doctor's cards, sah?" At the corner of the block in which he lived, Rudolph stopped for a glass of beer and a cigar. When he had come out with his lighted weed, he buttoned his coat, pushed back his hat and said, stoutly, to the lamppost on the corner, "All the same, I believe it was the hand of fate that doped out the way for me to find her." Which conclusion, under the circumstances, certainly admits Rudolf Steiner to the ranks of the true followers of romance and adventure. From the cabbie seat, the cabbie has his point of view. It is more single-minded, perhaps, than that of a follower of any other calling. From the high, swaying seat of his hansom, he looks upon his fellow men as nomadic particles, of no account except when possessed of migratory desires. He is Jehu, and you are goods in transit. Be you president or vagabond, to cabbie you are only a fare. He takes you up, cracks his whip, joggles your vertebrae, and sets you down. When time for payment arrives, if you exhibit a familiarity with legal rates, you come to know what contempt is. If you find that you have left your pocketbook behind, you are made to realize the mildness of dance imagination. It is not an extravagant theory that the cabbie's singleness of purpose and concentrated view of life are the results of the hansom's peculiar construction. The cock of the roost sits aloft like Jupiter on an unshareable seat, holding your fate between two thongs of inconstant leather. Helpless, ridiculous, confined, bobbing like a toy mandarin, you sit like a rat in a trap, you, before whom butlers cringe on solid land, and must squeak upward through a slit in your peripatetic sarcophagus, to make your feeble wishes known. Then, in a cab, you are not even an occupant, you are contents. You are a cargo at sea, and the Arab that sits up aloft has Davy Jones Street and number by heart. One night there were sounds of revelry in the big brick tenement house next door, but one to McGarry's family cafe. The sound seemed to emanate from the apartments of the Walsh family. The sidewalk was obstructed by an assortment of interested neighbors, who opened a lane from time to time for a hurrying messenger bearing from McGarry's goods pertinent to festivity and diversion. The sidewalk contingent was engaged in comment and discussion from which it made no effort to eliminate the news that Nora Walsh was being married. In the fullness of time there was an eruption of the merrymakers to the sidewalk. The uninvited guests enveloped and permeated them, and upon the night air rose joyous cries, congratulations, laughter and unclassified noises born of McGarry's oblations to the hymeneal scene. Close to the curb stood Jerry O'Donovan's cab. Nighthawk was Jerry called, but no more lustrous or cleaner handsome than his ever closed its doors upon point lace and November violets. And Jerry's horse. I am within bounds when I tell you that he was stuffed with oats until one of those old ladies who leave their dishes unwashed at home and go about having expressmen arrested would have smiled, yes, smiled to have seen him. Among the shifting, sonorous, pulsing crowd glimpses could be had of Jerry's high hat, battered by the winds and rains of many years, of his nose like a carrot, battered by the frolicsome athletic progeny of millionaires, and by contumacious fares, of his brass-buttoned green coat, admired in the vicinity of McGarry's. It was plain that Jerry had usurped the functions of his cab, and was carrying a load. Indeed, the figure may be extended, and he be likened to a bread wagon, if we admit the testimony of a youthful spectator, who was heard to remark, "Jerry has got a bun." Greater than from somewhere among the throng in the street, or else out of the thin stream of pedestrians, a young woman tripped and stood by the cab. The professional hawk's eye of Jerry caught the movement. He made a lurch for the cab, overturning three or four onlookers and himself. No, he caught the cap of a water plug, and kept his feet. Like a sailor shinning up the ratlins during a squall, Jerry mounted to his professional seat. Once he was there, McGarry's liquids were baffled. He seesawed on the mizzenmast of his craft as safe as a steeplejack rigged to the flagpole of a skyscraper. "Step in, lady," said Jerry, gathering his lines. The young woman stepped into the cab. The doors shut with a bang. Jerry's whip cracked in the air. The crowd in the gutter scattered, and the fine hansom dashed away cross town. When the youth's spry horse had edged a little his first spurt of speed, Jerry broke the lid of his cab, and called down through the aperture in the voice of a cracked megaphone, trying to please. "Where, now, will ye be driving to?" "Anywhere you please," came up the answer, musical and contented. "'Tis driving for pleasure she is," thought Jerry. And then he suggested as a matter of course, "Take a trip around in the park, lady. 'Twill be elegant, cool, and fine." "Just as you like," answered the fare, pleasantly. The cab headed for Fifth Avenue, and sped up that perfect street. Jerry bounced and swayed in his seat. The potent fluids of McGarry were disquieted, and they sent new fumes to his head. He sang an ancient song of Kiliznook, and brandished his whip like a baton. Inside the cab the fare sat up straight on the cushions, looking to right and left at the lights and houses. Even in the shadowed hansom her eyes shone like stars at twilight. When they reached 59th Street Jerry's head was bobbing, and his reins were slack. But his horse turned in through the park gate, and began the old familiar nocturnal round. And then the fair leaned back, entranced, and breathed deep the clean wholesome odors of grass and leaf and bloom. And the wise beast in the shafts, knowing his ground, struck into his by the hour gate, and kept to the right of the road. Habit also struggled successfully against Jerry's increasing torpor. He raised the hatch of his storm-tossed vessel, and made the inquiry that cabbies do make in the park. Like stop at the casino, lady? Jezzer freshens, and listen the music. Eve body stops. I think that would be nice, said the fare. They reined up with a plunge at the casino entrance. The cab doors flew open. The fare stepped directly upon the floor. At once she was caught in a web of ravishing music, and dazzled by a panorama of lights and colors. Someone slipped a little square card into her hand on which was printed a number 34. She looked around and saw her cab 20 yards away already lining up in its place among the waiting mass of carriages, cabs and motor cars. And then a man who seemed to be all shirt front danced backward before her, and next she was seated at a little table by a railing over which climbed a jessamine vine. There seemed to be a wordless invitation to purchase. She consulted a collection of small coins, in a thin purse, and received from them license to order a glass of beer. There she sat, inhaling and absorbing it all the new-colored, new-shaped life in a fairy palace in an enchanted wood. At 50 tables sat princes and queens clad in all the silks and gems of the world. And now and then one of them would look curiously at Jerry's fare. They saw a plain figure dressed in a pink silk of the kind that is tempered by the word owlard, and a plain face that wore a look of love of life that the queens envied. Twice the long hands of the clocks went round, royalties thinned from their tilde alfresco tilde thrones, and buzzed or clattered away in their vehicles of state. The music retired into cases of wood, and bags of leather and baize. Waiters removed cloths pointedly near the plain figure sitting almost alone. Jerry's fare rose, and held out her numbered card simply. Is there anything coming on the ticket? She asked. A waiter told her it was her cab check, and that she should give it to the man at the entrance. This man took it, and called the number. Only three hansoms stood in line. The driver of one of them went, and routed out Jerry asleep in his cab. He swore deeply, climbed to the captain's bridge, and steered his craft to the pier. His fare entered, and the cab whirled into the cool fastnesses of the park. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.